Well, Maria Coffey is the perfect blend of author and adventurer. Her books are as adventurous as her vacation travel. Got a cool website. See her on TV. She takes a lot of groups on some pretty amazing trips. But the trip she's going to take you on tonight, you won't have to leave your chair for. We will explore the infinite through the lives of extreme athletes. Their paranormal experiences shared for the first time in Explorers of the Infinite, Maria Coffey next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Maria Coffey lives in Vancouver, British Columbia, but really her home is the world in all of its thin places and hidden places. That's why the website is hiddenplaces.net. Thank you, Maria Coffey, for giving us time tonight and helping us explore the infinite.
Hello there.
Okay, so I'm really excited about this because I've been thinking about you a lot over the last week or so that I've been reading the book. Even tonight when I was watching the Miss Universe pageant, which was held in Vietnam, and it was Jerry Springer, which was the downside. But the upside was they showed this really beautiful sort of file footage, I guess, of Vietnam and some of the bays and some of the really cool places around Vietnam, which I assume you've been to about a million times.
They probably showed Ha Long Bay, which is where we go kayaking with a group every single year, which is one of my favorite places in the world. And actually one of the most spiritual, mystical places in the world, too.
Yep, all except for the Jerry Springer part.
Yeah, he might kind of take away from that spiritual experience. I don't think I'd have him on a trip.
but that's right. But that's exactly where they showed this group of Miss Universe contestants traveling through on some boat, and it just looked beautiful. But it got me to thinking, where in the world have you not been? Where haven't you been yet?
I haven't been to the Antarctic yet.
And, holding you back?
Well, you know, it's just been time. My husband's actually going there in January. He's going to be leading a trip with kayaking components. And unfortunately, I'm not able to go, but I will be going in 2010. We will be leading some trips in 2010. And I'm really looking forward to it because I guess, you know, we spend a lot of time in warmer places of the world, but you know, the poles, we've always been sort of thinking about going. And actually, we've just recently come back from the northern part of Norway. We were kayaking 120 miles north of the Arctic Circle, and that was in the Lofoten Islands. And again, for me, that was a new experience, being in the midnight sun, 24-hour sunshine.
I wonder how long it'll be before, and as sad as this might be in some respects, and also equally fascinating, before you could kayak across the North Pole.
Oh, I hope never. I hope
maybe, but perhaps by the end of the summer, the way that some people are predicting that the ice will melt.
I hope they're wrong.
But that would be an extreme adventure, wouldn't it?
It would.
Yeah. I mean, if it did melt and you could do it, wouldn't you lead a group there on vacation travel there?
I don't think so. That might be a bit. I mean, the trips that we lead are not extreme adventure; they're more gentle adventure.
Well, what's the difference between 120 miles north of the Arctic Circle and the North Pole?
Well, I guess there aren't icebergs where we were, and it just would be less extreme and less exposed.
All right. Well, and the adventure travel part of your life is very interesting, and I want to get to the book, and we'll do that. But let's talk a little bit about this, because you take groups to the Galapagos Islands. You take people on trips where there's a component, like three or four different components, like biking, hiking, kayaking, that sort of thing, right? Where you do all those things in one.
We don't do biking.
You don't do biking. Okay.
Most of our trips have a kayaking component, but we do also lead a number of trips every year to the Galapagos Islands, which are really magical. And there's only a tiny bit of kayaking there, simply because there's so many other things to do there. But we take people to Vietnam, to Croatia. We've just come back from Norway. And we're normally based on a mothership, a very beautiful boat, which is exactly the right size for our group of anything 10 to 15 people. And, for example, in Vietnam, we go deep, deep into Ha Long Bay, far away from any other tourists. And so we're living on a very comfortable boat with an excellent chef, good food, good wines. And in the day, we go exploring by kayak into this really magical landscape. And we do the same in Croatia. Again, we're on a beautiful yacht, and we paddle by day. We usually end up paddling into a harbor, an ancient Venetian harbor in one of the islands to meet the boat and have a wonderful meal ashore in one of the restaurants. So it's a mixture of going out into the wild and, you know, really exploring. And then, but there's comfort in the evenings.
So it's kind of like the beginning of a James Bond movie where he takes off his scuba suit and he's got a tuxedo underneath.
Exactly, yeah, except we don't expect people to wear tuxedos.
No, but it's got that cool combo to it, you know?
Yeah, it's really, and, you know, Doug and I lead a lot of the trips ourselves, and we develop them all ourselves. We're a photographer-writer team, and we go to places that we're really passionate about, and we've spent a lot of time in and explored and have long connections with and know a lot of people there. So they're very personal trips, and people love them.
Love the thought of that. Well, then let me push that a little bit further, though, and ask you, because I mentioned the term earlier, and you've been around the world enough. Where have you experienced the earth in its thinnest places, where you felt like there was a stronger connection between this world and then perhaps a spiritual dimension that was easier to perceive either with the eyes or with the heart?
Two places. I'll tell you the first place. In 1992, my husband Doug and I spent a year traveling around the world with a folding kayak, and just the two of us, and kayaking in different parts of the world. You know, we'd fly to different parts, different places with our kayak and put it together and then just go exploring. And one of those places was India, where we kayaked down 1,500 miles of the River Ganges, India's holy river. And we kayaked from Haridwar, where the river comes out of the Himalayas and flows into the central plains of India, and we followed it down to the holy city of Varanasi. And it was a very, very demanding journey in many ways. The river, it was pre-monsoon season, so the river had shrunk to this maze of channels that we often got lost in. The channels are out in the midst of a 10-mile-wide floodplain that for the first part of the journey, it was like kayaking through a desert. There were bandits that we had to worry about. There were floating bodies in the river. We passed countless cremations at the side of the river. The people that we met, the villagers, treated us wonderfully, took us into their homes, looked after us. They were constantly warning us about bandits, but they also kept saying to us, you are on a pilgrimage, because they believed that Hindus believe that the River Ganges embodies a goddess, the Holy Mother Ganga. And they said, because you are on this river, on the Holy Mother Ganga, because you're going between two pilgrimage sites, you will be protected. And during that journey, I'd set out with this completely rational mind. We were just on a kayaking trip, and during that journey, I began to feel protected by the river. And I can't explain it, but it became a really spiritual journey for me. And we were protected. I mean, I wasn't even sick once in our 6-week journey, and I was bathing in the river, drinking from it sometimes.
Oh, that's amazing. Because
it was a deeply profound journey. I mean, it became a completely spiritual odyssey for me.
I can so see that. Tell me a little bit more about the dead bodies, because I know that they float down the Ganges. It's part of the funereal rite of the Hindu. But what was that like? Because I imagine you would be getting bodies in various forms of decomposition.
At first, it was deeply shocking. I mean, the first time that we saw, you know, we're paddling along and this, you know, we suddenly see that there's this horribly decomposing body to our left. I mean, it was awful. But, you know, very quickly, we very quickly came to accept it as part of the cycle of life and death on the river. I have to say, we also learned how to avoid getting too close to them, because often that they'd be wrapped in cloth and the cloth would balloon up like a pillowcase, you know, filled with air. And also you'd see wild dogs swimming out towards them, to have a, you know, to
a snack.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, it never, I mean, obviously it was always shocking, but yet it just became something that, you know, that was part of life and death on the river. As were the cremations. We paddled past countless cremations where bodies were laid on pyres, funeral pyres, smeared in ghee and set alight. And I mean, the smell, you know, was more disquieting than anything at first.
Right.
But again, I mean, it was, I think, you know, it was, you know, we're so disassociated from death in our culture.
Well, that's why I'm going to ask you another dead body question, and I promised to move off it, but I'm curious. Other than the wild dogs, what eats the bodies in the Ganges?
Snapping turtles lower down the river. In fact, around Varanasi, the government have introduced more turtles into the river.
To try to keep up with the body flow?
And I think, actually, these days they're trying to dissuade people from... The reason that bodies are put into the river, sometimes it's because people are too poor. They just simply don't have the fuel to burn the bodies. But usually it's sadhus, the holy men, if they die, they're put into the river, complete, that being burnt. In some areas, strangely enough, if people have died of snake bite or infectious diseases, they're put into the river. And in some areas, unmarried people... unmarried adults are put into the river if they die rather than being cremated. So there are all various reasons.
I wonder why that is. What is it? Because if they're unmarried, they don't have an adult child to light the pyre. Isn't that the tradition?
That's really interesting. You know, I actually don't know. We had an Indian guide with us, a lovely young man called Bappy, who was from Mumbai, and. He actually was very upset when he learnt about this tradition in some areas, because he said, well, what if I die on the river now? Does that mean you will put me in the river?
Right.
He didn't know any, you know, nobody could. Hinduism is such a complicated religion, you know, and then nobody could give us a clear answer as to why that was.
I covered a cremation. I write a little bit, and I covered once a cremation in a traditional, you know, American, what do they call them now? Not creamery. What am I looking? Not crematory. They have another word for it. I can't remember what it's called.
Crematorium.
It's not, though. They're trying not to use that word because the aureum part sounds really medieval. So they came up with another word. I can't remember. It's not. Anyway. So they have this. They put the body in, and the day I was there doing a story, there was a Hindu family that was doing a ceremony right there. And the oldest male child had to hit the button to start the fire.
Oh, right.
And I thought that was so interesting. They sort of had translated it into the technological, you know, example.
Because we watched the eldest male child smear the body in ghee, walk around seven times with a torch, and then set fire to either end. So that's interesting.
And then what was the other place that you found? You said that there are two thin places, and that was one.
The other place was Everest.
I
went to Everest in 1982 before it became a commercial nightmare.
Right.
And I went there because my boyfriend had disappeared without trace near to the summit of Everest some months earlier with another man, two very well-known British climbers, and I went there with the widow of the other man. We basically followed in their footsteps as far as we could up the north side of Everest to their advanced base camp at 21,000 feet. And I'd never been that high before. I've never been that high since. And I really sensed the spiritual power of that mountain. Obviously it was a profound experience because of what we were doing. You know, basically trying to make sense of the disappearance of these men and get some sense of their last days. But, you know, we trekked up there. We had some Tibetan porters with us who would regularly, as we got closer and closer to the mountain, would stop and pray and leave prayer flags at cairns. And I really, as I got closer to the mountain, being high in the Himalayas anyway is an overwhelming experience because of these incredibly beautiful mountains, and they really do seem to be touching heaven. But I really did feel, again, it was like breaking through the veil and see, this isn't just a big pile of rock. This is this is a very powerful force, and I am a tiny dot.
Did you find your boyfriend?
No, we knew they actually disappeared very close to the summit, and we couldn't get close to the summit. We didn't go there expecting to do that. His body has never been found. The body of the other man was found 10 years later, lying in the snow, higher than everybody thought they'd reached. So they were basically last seen. It's called the second pinnacle. It's kind of the last obstacle before you head up to, before the long slog up to the summit.
I remember reading Krakauer's book, and he talks about that a little bit.
Right, right. And this is on the north side of the mountain, though, on the Tibetan side. Basically, they'd climbed 14 hours on their summit attempt. The rest of the team were watching them from the North Col through powerful telescopes, and they saw them as night fell, going behind the second pinnacle on this, basically on this ridge, this really sharp ridge. And at daybreak, the rest of the team got back onto the telescopes, and Joe and Pete never reappeared. So they always thought they'd fallen down the other side of this ridge, and it would have been a 12,000-foot drop. But in fact, Pete's body was found 10 years later, and what they must have done was carried on climbing into the night. So some people think they made it to the summit and were on their way down. I mean, it's another mystery like Mallory and Irvin.
Yeah. Well, and is that your inspiration for your book on the dark side of extreme sports?
Yes. My very first, how I began writing actually was to try and make sense of what had happened to Joe Tasker, my boyfriend. I wrote my very first book, Fragile Edge, about our relationship and about my journey to Everest. And then I wrote many other books about my travels and adventures with my husband, Doug. And then realized that I had some more work to do on the whole mountaineering thing and came back to look at the personal cost of climbing in a much broader sense. And that's when I wrote Where the Mountain Casts Its Shadow, The Dark Side of Extreme Adventure. And I interviewed many of the world's top mountaineers and their families, more importantly, their wives or their spouses, their children, their parents, trying to give a picture of the emotional impact of mountaineering. You know, all the stories behind the headlines, you know, what happens to the people left behind.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, that will bring us to two things. We'll start to explore the infinite then. No wonder you have the street cred, or I guess the mountain cred, as it were, to have extreme athletes, extreme adventurers talk to you mm-hmm. about their experiences. Obviously, they see in you somebody who has been there alongside of them, if not as deep into the areas that they explore, you can at least relate to where they are. And we'll talk about that, the secret spiritual lives of extreme athletes, what they reveal about near-death experiences, psychic communication, and touching the beyond, explorers of the infinite. And just to wrap it up, the word I was looking for was crematory.
All right.
The industry prefers the word crematory these days. So every time I say crematorium, I'll get an email from somebody
like
going,
creamery, though.
That's where I thought I was getting the word mixed up. So we'll pick it up right there in the next half hour with Maria Coffey. Explorers of the infinite, what have these extreme athletes seen and felt? What have they been withholding until they told her about what they have seen in the zone? Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Explorers of the infinite, Maria Coffey is our guest. The secret spiritual lives of extreme athletes. We're going to get to some of the stories coming up in just a moment. Enjoy talking with her. You can link up to her website at coasttocoastam.com, and you can take a look at some of the adventure travel that they do, and she and her husband could take you to some of these hidden places around the world. Unfortunately, if you look down the list, most of the trips are sold out, and sold out at you know, not exactly bargain basement rates. And it, believe me, it sounds like a bargain when you look at where you're going and what you're going to do when you get there, but this is travel that might be a once-in-a-lifetime experience. You ought to take a look at it, or just pick up a copy of the book, and you'll feel like you're there. In fact, what if What if extreme adventure? What if sports at a high level turned out to be some sort of portal into a different spiritual dimension? What if the reason why extreme athletes do what they do is because they get addicted to the spiritual component of being in the zone? Not just the physical, not just the endorphin rush, but actually a kind of a mental breakthrough. Almost, if you will, a little bit like a paradigm shift of the way in which they're looking at the world that's around them. But it's only possible when you get to a certain place, when you really push your body and your mind and your soul, you might actually push through to the other side. The type of paranormal experiences that few on the planet experience, coming up next with Maria Coffey on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Maria Coffey's been talking about her experiences in adventure travel and some of the amazing places she's been allowed to go to and some of the places that took her inside to a place within her that she also enjoyed. And so it is that I think we have just sort of a step up toward where these extreme athletes are going. In fact, when did you first start to interview athletes? Who was the first extreme athlete who pulled back the curtain a little bit on their own life and let you know that there was something going on that they hadn't talked about before?
I'm just trying to think who the first one was. I think it may have been Carlos Castillo, who is a Mexican mountaineer. I talked to him early in the process of doing research for my book, and he opened up very quickly and said, you know, what Carlos said was that he'd had many hallucinations. You know, the typical thing that mountaineers talk about of the third man on the rope and things like that.
I don't know what that means. Tell me what that means.
Okay, so. Somebody, you're climbing up a mountain and you have the sense that there is a third person with you, when in fact there's only two people. Many, many climbers and other sorts of athletes have talked about that.
When they say that, is it because they see it or because they feel it?
Both, actually.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, a solo sailor just recently who'd read the book told me, and this is what's happening now, I'm getting a lot of stories from people who have had similar experiences but have been worried about talking about them before.
So there will be a sequel then.
I don't know, but he was talking Yeah, he was talking about being on a 21-day sailing trip in the Southern Ocean, a very, very punishing trip, and there were three of them on the boat, and he became convinced there were four people, and so convinced he was actually cooking for the fourth person. So,
what does that remind you of? Does anything? There's several Bible stories about that.
Oh,
think about that.
You would know that better than me.
Yeah, but I throw that out at you, and because I think that's such an intriguing concept that when you know when there were people in extremely dangerous conditions, were in near fatal circumstances, they looked up and there was another person there. And the way the story reads is it's the angel of God who's there to protect them.
Mm-hmm. So
that's why I asked about whether they saw it or felt it on the rope, because feeling it on the rope would be a very different thing than just like seeing a kind of a hazy hallucination, but actually feeling the tug of another person on the rope, that would be really...
Usually it's seeing them.
Okay, all right, just checking.
So, you know, I'd heard this, heard there were some stories, you know, that mountaineers had written about, but Carlos was saying that he had had other kinds of experiences that he knew were not simple hallucinations that could be explained through, you know, lack of oxygen. He'd had other experiences of being guided down mountains in extreme conditions through terrible blizzards by spirits of the mountain and also by ghosts of climbers who died on that particular mountain.
Okay, freaky.
And he said to me, these are not hallucinations because I've had hallucinations. I know what those are like. These were my moments of extended reality. And he had never talked about those in public before. And the interesting thing about him, too, is that he said it was to reach those moments that he really pushed himself as a mountaineer. He climbed. He ended up climbing the world's. He was the youngest person to climb the world's 14 highest mountains without oxygen.
Hmm. Well, and so he sees these things, and the sailor you mentioned saw something. And did they get a sense of peace from that hallucination or whatever it was? Did they feel like, uh-oh, something's going wrong? Did they feel more confident as a result of it? Did it help focus them?
In the case of Carlos Corsolio, and other mountaineers have talked about this too, and they felt guided. So it's not really a sense of peace. It's more a sense of being helped and guided by the spirit of the mountain or by the ghost.
Fascinating.
Many mountaineers now have told me about struggling down a mountain in terrible conditions and just feeling that somebody is really helping them. They either see somebody or they're following somebody, or they just get the sense of a presence of somebody who is just showing them the way. And that actually is quite a common story now from all that I've talked to.
Wow. Well, that's how you started it, because you referred to it as the common experience of the extra climber that was out there, and then I made you go on that sidebar. So help me get you back onto the track where you were talking. Was that enough that when you were talking about Carlos again that you got it all in there? Because I think that's such an interesting idea. Does this speak to what you wrote about in your book about how athletes get kind of addicted to that experience, that there's something about that that they just want to keep revisiting?
I think the experience that they've talked, I mean, there was one climber in particular fairly early on in my research who said that she felt that climbing was a spiritual addiction, because it's about reaching a state of altered being that they can't reach in any other way. And I think, you know, I think that is more the addiction rather than the paranormal experiences, because they are more rare, I think, for most people, whereas the sense of spiritual peace, the sense of connectedness with the wild world that they find when they are out really pushing themselves to the limit, you know, I think that is what draws them back time and time again. And that is what, when I first started talking to extreme athletes, mountaineers were the first ones that I was talking to actually for my previous book. And, you know, I was saying to them, you know, what is it that causes you to keep leaving your families time and time again to risk your lives in the mountains? And almost all of them talked about finding a spiritual peace in the mountains that they couldn't find anywhere else. And that's really what sparked my interest in the whole subject.
Yeah. Again, we're talking with Maria Coffey. The book is Explorers of the Infinite. You can link up to her through our webpage at coasttocoastam.com. And so when they see the ghosts of these dead climbers, do the ghosts ever speak to them?
Well, there are so many different stories. You know, often it's just...
us one.
There was one couple who told me a story about they had what I call a joint visitation on Kanchenjunga in the Himalayas. This is an American couple, Lou and Ingrid Whitaker. Lou Whitaker is a very famous American mountaineer, and this is back in the 80s, and he was on Kanchenjunga with an American team trying to put up the first American ascent of the mountain. His wife was leading a trekking group. So halfway through the expedition, she was heading up to the mountain, heading up to his base camp to visit him. But before she came, while he was at base camp, every night as he was falling to sleep, he would sense the presence of a Tibetan woman, an elderly Tibetan woman in the tent with him, a woman dressed in traditional clothes. And he said she was just this comforting presence. She would be in the tent, just sort of hovering around. He described her as kind of two-dimensional, but somebody who was just very calming and comforting, and he would just know that she was there as he was falling asleep. Well, then his wife, Ingrid, arrived to meet him, and as soon as she got to base camp, she got altitude sickness. She was very, very sick for 3 days, and basically she just lay in his tent for 3 days while he was on the mountain. They were putting fixed camps up the mountain, so he was off climbing every day. Then he would come back in the evening to be with her. But she was so ill she could barely speak to him. And in the day, she didn't tell him this at the time, but in the day when she was lying there delirious with this terrible headache, she would sense the presence of an elderly Tibetan woman in the tent who would be hovering around and who, in Ingrid's case, would actually not speak to her, but basically help her to turn over. She'd kind of feel the sense of a hand on her forehead, kind of, you know, reassuring her. Now, Ingrid didn't tell her husband about this, nor did he tell Ingrid about what he sensed at night. It was only 2 months later. She had to leave the mountain very quickly and go to a lower altitude because it was too dangerous for her to stay up there. 2 months later, he got back to the States after the expedition was finished. And one day they were sitting talking about when she visited him there, and she very hesitantly told him about sensing this presence when she was very ill. And he said, well, that's really funny because I sensed a very similar presence every night. And when they compared notes, it was their experience was almost identical.
Mm. Oh, that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. And yet you're saying not alone. I mean, that it's not it's something they experienced together, but then you couple that with other climbers having similar experiences, and you really start to get kind of a feel for what? Could it just be attributed to the thinning of the altitude? To the sort of oxygen acclimation, or do you think there's something that's actually happening?
Well, you know, mainstream scientists, you'll tell them a story like that, and they will say, oh, it's because of lack of oxygen creating, for example, they say it creates miniature seizures in the brain, and, you know, in laboratory conditions, if people's brains are, if people are under control conditions are given miniature seizures, they'll often sense a presence. So that's what scientists will always say. It's just something to do with a lack of oxygen. But there are other kinds of adventurers who've had spirit and ghost encounters at sea level. And you can't, there's no oxygen deprivation explanation in those situations.
Well, I'd like to have you tell one of those stories, but I want to go back since you mentioned sea level again. It makes me think about the guy in the boat who sensed another presence with him.
Exactly.
Would you put that in the category of a ghost, or how would you describe that? In the context of the paranormal, how is that categorized?
I guess what I call a ghost is the spirit of a deceased person. That's what I would call a ghost. Other mountaineers have given me stories. For example, Carlos Carsolio, who I mentioned before, has talked about sensing the spirit of the mountain guiding him down.
The mountain itself as
yes,
a spirit, much like
I,
the way you've...
As I like, sensed on the Ganges, I sensed the spirit of the river. So, you know, it's almost like an animistic thing I sensed something powerful and alive in nature rather than the spirit of somebody who was once in the material realm of this earth and is now in a different realm.
So let's put that into two different categories then. Ghost experiences, mm-hmm. Whether they communicated verbally or not, even just sort of almost sort of a supernatural presence, and then this actual sort of spirit guides that seem to be there to reassure, to point, mm-hmm. to assist, to protect.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were saying then that some of these other experiences fall into that category at sea level, which leads you to believe it's not just oxygen deprivation.
I absolutely think it's not just oxygen deprivation. I mean, I didn't think so at the beginning when I was first working on the book, but now I'm really with Carlos Carsolio. I think these are moments of extended reality, that people are tapping into something else.
Well, tell us one of those experiences then, too, that somebody confided in you that you put in the book.
One story that really intrigued me, Canadian climber and surfer called Clay Hunting. And this wasn't at altitude either. He was ice climbing in the Canadian Rockies, so he wasn't very high. He was climbing with a friend. They were both very experienced ice climbers. They were climbing a waterfall, and it collapsed. and his climbing partner, who was called Sean Smearden, was very, very badly injured in the waterfall collapse. An eyeball popped out. He had many broken bones. You know, his face was all smashed up. I mean, he was really, really badly damaged. Now, this was before the days of cell phones. So Clay had to get out to hike out many miles to get help. And he ended up having to hike through the night, through some canyons, and try and find his way out because they were going to camp up there. They had, you know, they had no intention of coming back that night. Now, he had a headlamp, but he said that as he was trying to find his way, suddenly he became aware of a blue light that wasn't his headlight, his headlamp, because that was a different color. And he's convinced it also wasn't a reflection. And this blue light was always ahead of him. And he began to follow it. And sometimes he'd stop and he'd turn off his headlamp and he'd look for the light. And he said sometimes the blue light would be a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right. Wherever it was, he would follow it. And he believes that that light guided him out. And he got out just in time to call for help, to mount a helicopter rescue. They picked up Sean and they got him to hospital just in time. He was so hypothermic and so badly injured that it was really touch and go by the time they got him to hospital, but he did survive. And, I mean, Clay can't explain what that light was, but there was something, and he insists it wasn't his headlamp, that helped him out of that terrible situation.
Well, I promise not to do this a lot, but since you hit this nerve with me, I'll just share this. In light of everything you just said, here's from the Hebrew Scriptures, Daniel 3. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astounded and stood up in haste, and he said to his high officials, "Was it not three men we cast bound into the midst of the fire?" And they replied to the king, "Certainly, O king." And he said, "Well, look, I see four men loosed and walking among the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods."
I wish I'd interviewed you for my book. I think I'll have to do a new edition.
But isn't that fascinating to think?
It's amazing.
Tie that together like that? I mean, the fourth man on the rope, and then here you got this story that goes back, you know, 3,000 years to the book of Daniel. I mean, that's just...
Yeah, that is amazing. Yeah.
And yet you did interview somebody who was a vicar in the Church of England, and I want you to talk about that a little bit, because that was very compelling research, too, making these spiritual connections. And we'll talk more about the paranormal and near-death experiences, the psychic communication, and what it means to touch the beyond with Maria Coffey. She is a writer of The Explorers of the Infinite. They have told her their stories, in many cases confessing to her for the first time the things that they had been through, which they just kind of felt maybe too embarrassed to say out loud before, but found a perfect voice in her. And we'll talk about it next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, we started the show with something really mystical in the first half hour. If you missed it, you can log on to coasttocoastam.com and log on to my blog from there. Because I put a link on my blog tonight about a story, picked it up off a website. It's way cool. A little bit like the work of Dr. Omoto, the Japanese scientist who's been studying the effects of sound waves on water. Well, putting that research aside for the moment, that's very interesting. This particular video is of regular old table salt on a metal surface that is being vibrated by sound waves. And it's the repetition of the patterns. It's so fascinating. Sometimes, by the way, those patterns look distinctly like crop circles. But I'll just put that aside, too, for the moment, because I'm not trying to make that point. I'm just trying to say that you could look at that vibrating metal table and you could see the crosses and the circles that keep coming up in repetition in these sound wave patterns in the salt. And you could say, well, that's just there's a scientific explanation for it. It's just the waves and frequencies, and I don't know, maybe you're right. I am the dumbest guy I know. But I can't help but look at that and see something more mystical at work. And I can't quite come to a place that says all of these things can just be explained by science as we know it. But I think somewhere in the world there are these levels of metaphysics that reach over all of us. And that's what we're exploring in Explorers of the Infinite. Maria Coffey will continue to share her experiences with extreme athletes, revealing to her what has happened to them when they've reached a certain place, a certain zone that these extreme athletes get into, where they see and feel the paranormal. They don't talk about it much. They did talk about it with her, and we'll talk about the experience of those who have remembered the future before it's happened in dream and waking states and what they shared with Maria Coffey on that this hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Maria Coffey, I keep reflecting back on something you said last half hour about these extreme athletes being aware of the difference between a hallucination and what they were seeing when they were in one of these zones where they were pushing their body and their mind to the limit. Can I ask you a little bit more about that? Because I think that's an intrigue. I've had hallucinations, and I've been very aware of the fact that I was hallucinating at the time because I was tired or ill or whatever. But I don't know that I would understand that difference between a hallucination and something that I was seeing. Can you talk about that?
I'm not sure I totally understand. And I think there is a crossover, too. I mean, the person who told me that, Carlos Carsolio, what he was saying was that he felt that his most profound experiences were not caused by mini seizures of the brain, you know, which is apparently what science says are the causes of hallucinations. He really believes that he was tapping into another realm of experience.
Right.
And, you know, I think that is the difference. You know, it's not like something that is you know, maybe drug-induced or, you know,
right.
It really is, you know, a pushing into a whole other realm of consciousness. And I mean, it's obviously a very hard thing to explain because we are talking about a major mystery zone here that science hasn't even begun being able to explain yet.
So I guess that takes us into a couple of different areas in the book Explorers of the Infinite, because the one place we could talk about here before we get to the remembering the future piece, which I thought was fascinating, is the work that was being done by that English, who's a vicar, wasn't he? He was a priest.
Reverend Neil Elliott, yes.
Yeah, and he was studying this kind of, I used the word portal earlier because it felt like that while I was reading it, that there was a kind of a door that, or this passageway or a thin bridge or something that somebody was passing over. And he worked with people on that because he was writing about what that would be like. And maybe that this is what people have always been pursuing. Maybe that is how we get to that other dimension, is through extreme athletics. What was his research? He was doing a PhD project or something, wasn't he?
He was doing a PhD into the spirituality of snowboarding. Now, in the year of he's a vicar at the University of Central England, which is in Birmingham. And in the year of his ordination, which was 1997, he'd been a skier for many years, but then he discovered snowboarding on powder. And I'm sure most of your listeners know what that is, but it's very deep, light, freshly fallen snow. And he was in the Alps the first time he skied powder, and he skied down very early in the morning down a slope before anybody else had skied on it, and had that experience that many deep powder skiers talk about of, first of all, you're going through this deep snow, and it's like feathers. It's puffing up all around you. It's sparkling, filled with sparkling light. And then they go into this zone of he felt this calm descending on him. The effort of turning just disappeared. He was basically detached, as if the board was guiding him. And he was in that zone of everything flowing. He said he was like in and out of time. He was just pure being, and he felt that he was very close to God at that point. Now, he, just after this, heard the term soul riding, which is what many snowboarders talk about, that they describe when they go off-piste into the backcountry to to ski in big bowls of fresh powder. They call that soul riding. And he became intrigued as to what did they mean. Was it for them? Was it the same experience that he'd had? So that's what he set off to discover that. And what he found was that all of the snowboarders that he was interviewing were having the same experience, but unlike him, they didn't have a language for it. They didn't have a language to describe the spirituality of that experience. And he calls such experiences, you know, being out in nature, being in the zone like that, he calls them raw spiritual experiences. And obviously he believes in God, in a personal God, and he believes that his personal God is reveals himself to the world in many different ways. And one of the ways that he reveals himself is through these raw spiritual experiences that you can have in nature.
I wonder how that relates to the spiritual experiences that people have when they are going through deprivation of one type or another, whether it's sensory deprivation in like a sensory deprivation tank, mm-hmm. or whether it's through fasting. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how those experiences correlate, where they cross over each other. Because I think that when we think about our day-to-day existence, we're so caught up in the mundane that there's no place for that. We don't have, I mean, with the rare exception of person out there, it really does take a kind of disorientation, a kind of incoherence in our experience, maybe, to open our eyes to what's really going around us at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And one thing, when I was doing the research for the book, I decided that there were three major components to the experiences of the extreme athletes, to these spiritual, mystical, and paranormal experiences, to reaching that portal. And the main components were focus, fear, and suffering. And suffering is really key. You talk to any of these extreme athletes, and when they talk about, I mean, to do what they do, they have to train extremely hard. They have to push themselves to the limit. For example, I talked to mountaineers who trained for very cold conditions by plunging their hands into ice water and leaving them there for half an hour. I talk to ultramarathoners who, you know, run stairs until they vomit. And, you know, I mean, you know, they really push themselves incredibly. But they talk, or Lance Armstrong, for example, he talks about suffering as absolutely necessary for what he does, that suffering for him, it's a cleansing. It's spiritual cleansing. And so I think you're absolutely right. You know, people have to, for the really extreme experiences to really push through to that portal, there has to be that element of suffering linked with extreme focus. That's also very important.
And well, that brings us to the word passion, of course, which originally meant suffering. And it's when we talk about athletes and you really feel their passion, that it's why we use passion for love, mm-hmm. is that you suffer for love. And it's why we use the term Passion of the Christ. It was the period of great suffering. And so it really pushes that idea about if you really are passionate about something, you don't really experience it until you're suffering. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to have sort of a passing experience of it until you're upside down in it, until you've lost all sense of who you are, until you've blurred your boundaries, mm-hmm. You're not really experiencing it yet.
And I do believe, and I write in the book, that it is the hardest experiences of our lives that crack us open and open up these portals. And I've had that experience. You know, I've had some very hard experiences myself that I know have allowed me to also have the most profound moments of my life. And, you know, I think anyone in any walk of life will agree with that. You know, you don't have to be an extreme athlete to understand that.
Explorers of the Infinite is the book about extreme athletes and their spiritual paranormal experiences. Maria Coffey wrote it. Maria, let me ask you about I'm going to jump ahead a few chapters just because I think it ties in nicely here. This idea of remembering the future, mm-hmm. and the things that athletes experienced in dreamlike or near dreamlike states, mm-hmm. And how that related to their own survival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were many. They were some of the most surprising stories, actually. There were many stories that they shared with me. A lot of climbers, but also some base jumpers, told stories of premonitions that often came through dreams, and sometimes these, you know, they'd shared them with friends, and these were premonitions of their own death, and which sadly came true.
Well, talk about that. Tell some of the ones you when you researched, you found, and that, this is what I love so much about your book. People that knew these stories, they might have shared these experiences together when they were alone, but for the first time, really, you've made it out into a wider circulation.
And often they hadn't even shared them with their peers. That was the interesting thing, that often they said, I haven't told anyone about this. There's a mountain climber called Jim Duff, who I'd known for many years, and he was on an expedition with another friend of mine where the called Nick Escort, where Nick was killed in an avalanche. That was on K2. Well, when I talked to Jim for the book, he told me that when he and Nick were in London at Heathrow Airport on their way to K2, about to fly out, Jim was the doctor on the expedition, and Nick turned to him and said, I've got this terrible feeling that I'm not going to be coming back from this expedition. And Jim, as the doctor, thought, oh, you know, it's just pre-expedition nerves, and he bought him a couple of brandies from the bar, you know, that
right.
Then they were on the long trek into K2, and they were sharing a tent. And one day, Nick woke up in the morning and said to Jim, said that he'd had this dream in which he died in an avalanche, and he was buried under blocks of ice. And another team member called Doug Scott was walking around poking among the ice blocks looking for him. And, well, you know, they laughed about this, and he'd actually said, oh, well, you know, the guy who was looking for me looked like a snow groomer, you know, that grooms the peace. And, so they just laughed about this. But Jim, the doctor, wrote about it in his journal. Well, 3 weeks later, Nick was actually swept away by an avalanche. Jim witnessed it. They called off the expedition. The next day, they trekked down to base camp, and on the way they got on the way down, they got to the point where the avalanche had ended, and there was this huge area of avalanche rubble, huge blocks of ice. Doug Scott unclipped from the rope and went out into the avalanche debris and was poking around with his ski sticks, trying to find some trace of Nick, a hat or a glove, something he could bring back to his wife. And Jim, the doctor, was sitting at the side thinking, this is terribly dangerous, he shouldn't be out there. And then suddenly he thought, this is Nick's dream. This is exactly what he dreamt, that he'd been killed in an avalanche and now Doug Scott was poking around in the ice blocks looking for him. That happened in the late 70s, and he didn't tell anyone about that until we talked.
Is it because they're so private, or because those experiences are so profound, or because there's some fear that if they share these stories, they'll be, I don't know, decertified, or nobody will want to put them on the rope when they climb together?
I think it's the last reason, and I think it's very common in our society. You know, we live in this rational age where if you believe in such things, people just, you know, laugh at you. And so I think there are so many people who are just embarrassed to admit these things. And time and time again, when I was talking to athletes of so many, all different kinds of athletes, they would express relief that somebody had actually given them permission to talk about this. And they were always surprised to hear that so many other extreme athletes had similar stories.
Mm. Tell me another one of somebody who remembered the future, so to speak.
There was a base jumper, a British base jumper called Dwayne Thomas, who was base jumping in the Alps. And base jumping is where he was basically jumping off a high cliff and then opening his parachute at the last minute. he had... The night before, he'd done many, many base jumps, and the night before, he hadn't slept properly, and his wife said she'd never known him to be so nervous. And the morning that he was setting off to do the base jump, one of his friends walked over to him just to sort of shake his hand, and Dwayne looked at him and said, "Don't ever look at me like that again." And his friend was like, "How am I looking at you? I don't know what you're talking about." And Dwayne just stormed off and went up to the top of the cliff. He was being filmed. And usually he just put his gear on, ran off the cliff, and off he went. He was very experienced. But this time it took him 5 minutes for some reason to pluck up courage or whatever to go off the cliff. And He jumped. He was free falling. People saw him reach back to deploy his parachute and just leave his hand there. He got so close to the ground, people were yelling at him to pull the cord, and he just hit the ground with a fatal force. It was so strange that he seemed to see something reflected in his friend's eyes, that he'd had this terrible night the night before, that he didn't feel he could jump off the cliff straight away. That's just another story of somebody seeming to sense the future.
But so he pulled the cord, or he never pulled the cord?
He did, but far too late.
Okay, so he pulled the cord, but too late, and therefore it didn't pull him up enough to keep him from crashing fatally to the earth.
He was only about 30 feet off the ground when he pulled it.
Oh.
Yeah.
And we just don't know why. Because he would have been so experienced to not, that wouldn't have been a rookie mistake or lack
he's
of
done,
depth
he's
perception.
Done literally hundreds of base jumps.
Weird.
He was one of England's most experienced base jumpers.
Weird.
Another story. Do you want another story?
Yeah, we're coming up to the bottom of the hour. Okay. Give us the headline of this one, and then we'll finish it on the other side.
Somebody who always was dreaming of falling rocks.
Oh yeah, I know this one. Oh, you want to stick around for it? It's Explorers of the Infinite. You can find out more about Maria Coffey's 12 books. Is that what you have? A dozen or so?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com. It'll also take you to the adventure travel website. And if there are any open spaces on those trips, you ought to consider exploring the finite with Maria Coffey and her husband, because those trips sound fabulous. But it's more than that. It's what other people have confided in her over the years that she's sharing for the first time, Explorers of the Infinite. And I want to ask more about some of the people who have contacted you since this book came out and some of the stories that you've heard since this book arrived, where people are confirming some of the things you talked about earlier. And I don't know whether we'll have a lot of time for callers, because I don't want to give her up yet. So maybe a little less time for calls next hour. I'm just warning you ahead of time. For Explorers of the Infinite on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So interesting. Talking with Maria Coffey, the author of Explorers of the Infinite. You can find out more on our webpage. And she's finding out more even as the book has come out, from other extreme athletes who, so often is the case, once their experiences have been normalized by the testimony of others, feel like it's all right for them to witness to what they've experienced too. And so we'll explore that a little bit more, along with more from the chapter about remembering the future, extreme athletes and premonitions of their own death or of their own near-death experiences. And we'll get to all of that coming up next on Coast to Coast AM on a Sunday night. This is Ian Punnett. Maria Coffey was just starting to tell us the experience of yet another extreme athlete that she has interviewed for Explorers of the Infinite. But before we go forward with that, did we fully get from you your own extreme story? Was it just the story about the Ganges that you mentioned, or were you referencing something else last half hour when you said you had had a glimpse of some of this of your own?
I've had a number of what I would call paranormal experiences, which I'd always kind of thought, oh, maybe it was just a product of my own brain, you know, before I had them. And I think through working on this book, that kind of turned me around. I've opened myself up to the mystery of them now. I guess the main one was after my boyfriend died on Everest. First of all, I had a very strong premonition of his death before I was told, because it was 3 weeks before we got the news, because again, this was the days, you know, before cell phones. And because they disappeared, the rest of the team wanted to make sure that they weren't coming back, you know, that they actually had died. So they, you know, they waited around hoping that they would reappear. I woke up. I was actually on a rock climbing course with some friends, and we were staying in a dormitory, three other girls. And they remember me waking up in the middle of the night, sitting bolt upright and screaming, "Joe's dead." And I had a dream in which I was running down a street in this little village where we were staying, with tears pouring down my face because I'd just been told that he was dead. When we traced it back, it was within 18 hours of his disappearance that I had that dream, 18 hours later. After the news came through that he had died, I began to sense his presence. The first time was when I was driving up to the house that we'd shared. I'd actually not been staying in it while he was away because it was being renovated. So I drove up to be there. A friend of mine was actually driving, and as we were approaching the house, I suddenly felt his presence in the car all around me. I didn't see him. It was just this comforting presence that gave me this intense sense of peace and reassurance. And my friend dropped me off at his house, and the presence stayed with me for hours, only very gradually faded away. The really strange thing about this is when I told my friend later that I'd had this sensation, she said, "Oh, I know, I felt it too." And I said, "When did you begin to feel it?" And she said, "It was when we were going under this particular bridge," and that's exactly when I felt it.
How about that?
And I felt his presence for years. It would always come with that warning, and a number of times on Everest. It would come with that warning. But after that, when I was writing my first book about him, I would suddenly feel him all around me. And again, you know, when he was alive, he often used to, if we were sitting together, he would just lay his hand on my neck, you know, just sort of, if we were watching television or something, he'd just sort of reach over and have his hand on my neck. And that's often what I would feel, this kind of pressure on my neck. And this sense of peace.
And when, with that sense of peace that you had, though, that you experienced, why did you feel the need to climb Everest yourself then?
Why? I didn't really climb it. I trekked. On the north side of Everest, you can actually trek up to 21,000 feet. And from that point on, it's technical climbing. I went there because Joe and Pete, his friend, they disappeared without trace. And that is, as I discovered at the age of 30, that is an incredibly hard bereavement, because when somebody just disappears, there's no concrete fact of their death. You can't really believe that they won't just walk back through the door sometime. There's no ritual to be had. You know, there's no body to say goodbye to. There's no funeral to be had. So Hillary, the widow of the other man, and I had to create our own ritual, and our ritual, our way of coming to terms with the fact that these men were actually dead and would never come back again into our lives, was by following in their footsteps as far as we could, which was up to Advanced Base Camp on Everest, 21,000 feet. And we went up there, and actually at base camp, we created a little memorial for them too. And so it was really a pilgrimage and a ritual and a way of coming to terms with the fact that they actually were gone.
After you came to terms with that, actually making this trek up Everest, even though you didn't come down with anything other than building that memorial, did the feeling of his hand on the back of your neck stop after that?
Oh, no. I felt his presence for many years after that. And then I would dream about him. In fact, I write about this in the book, and it was something that I'd never written about before. For years later, I would have dreams about him, and they became very confusing, because sometimes I would dream that he'd come back and didn't want to be with me anymore, and I would sort of wake up very distraught. And then I got married, and this is really strange.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is where it starts, where the kind of, I mean, is your, on your wedding night? I mean, do you feel his presence then? I mean,
what happened was, after I was married, and I'm very happily married to Doug, the dreams continued. And so I wrote my first book shortly after I got married, because I wrote my first book about Joe as a way to sort out the past so that I could go into the future with my new husband. But these dreams continued, and I would have these dreams where Joe had come back, he was alive, and he wanted us to be together again. And I would wake up in the arms of my husband, I would feel terribly conflicted and terribly confused. And years later, almost two decades after he died, I had one of these dreams. I woke up one morning, and I was really cross. And I actually sat up in bed, Doug was sleeping fast asleep beside me, and I said out loud, "Look, Joe, I love you. you'll always be part of my life, but these dreams have to stop. Please get out of my head. This has to stop. And I felt a bit silly. You know, I went downstairs, I made a cup of tea, you know, I sat there thinking about this, you know, feeling a bit strange about it all. But I haven't had one of those dreams again.
Have you ever seen the movie Always?
No.
You have to see the movie Always. It's a Steven Spielberg movie. It was the last movie that Audrey Hepburn made before she died. And it's a movie very similarly themed, about a woman who loses her boyfriend, her fiancé almost, and then he passes on, and he watches over her as a guardian angel, but he has a hard time letting go and letting her move on to the relationship that will be the love of her life.
Oh, interesting.
And conflicts her terribly until they have to have kind of a showdown.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you really have to, like rent this tomorrow and watch this.
Because
I mean, it's not just a very well-made movie, and it's very sweet, and the dialogue's terrific, but it is exactly your story. Oh. I mean, or Joe's story, anyway, if it's not your story. Well, very interesting. Well, thank you for that. And so Doug must be a very understanding fellow.
He is. He's a wonderful man. I mean, I began writing the book literally a few weeks after we got married, just because it just suddenly struck me. I had a difficult relationship with Joe. I mean, it's not easy living with a high-altitude mountaineer who's gone half the time risking his life.
Right.
And he died with a lot of unanswered questions between us. And, you know, I didn't want to carry that on into my marriage.
Sure.
Well, little did I know that it would take three books to really sort it out. And I feel I have with this last book, because my personal story came into it, even though I hadn't meant it to.
Right, to exercise that ghost. Mm. Yeah, and interestingly enough, though, too, and I'm not trying to push this, but I'm curious about it. I always feel this way. If we really do feel like there is a presence around us, then you almost have to block that out of your mind for moments of physical intimacy, don't you? I mean, it's kind of.
I've never sensed him at that point. I think he's far too well mannered.
Okay, good. So at least he's showing. So you're not feeling his hand on your neck okay, that would be a little weird.
Oh, that would be very. I think I would have shouted at him much earlier.
I find it hard enough when people say they leave their dogs in the room. I'm like, no, got to get the dogs out of it. We're talking with Maria Coffey. The book is Explorers of the Infinite. We left it off earlier about the chapter Remembering the Future, where people were having these, if not sort of premonitions of their death or premonitions of their survival anyway. And we were just talking about the big rocks. Want to pick that up there?
Yes, there was, again, this is somebody who I knew. This is very poignant for me. Alex McIntyre was a very close friend of mine. In fact, we were roommates for a couple of years. And he was a really, really fearless mountaineer, a really cutting-edge British mountaineer. And the only thing that unnerved him in the mountains were falling rocks. And other climbers said that, you know, when they were in rockfall, when they were on a rock face, he would just become a quivering wreck, which was very, very unlike Alex. He was up on Annapurna, making an attempt to climb it with an American and British team. And there was an American climber with him called John Porter, and they were old friends, actually. And actually, it was John who was having the premonitions. They were sharing a tent. They were camped out on the glacier. And John, every night, would suddenly wake up, sit bolt upright, convinced that he could hear rocks clattering down the glacier towards them, towards the tent. You know, sometimes that happened. And he would be really worried. He'd sit up thinking, oh, you know, there's a rock bombardment here. And then he'd go fully awake and realize that there were no rocks. He'd just kind of half dreamt this and imagined it. And he didn't mention this to Alex because Alex seemed not his usual cheerful self on the mountain. He seemed very, very troubled by something that he wasn't talking about. Well, Alex and another of the climbers went up to make an attempt on Annapurna. John Porter was ill at the time. He stayed down at base camp. He was watching them climb, and he was watching two of them. They'd actually got to a high point and then retreated, and he was watching them crossing this rock face, He looked away for a second, and when he looked back again, there was only one of them. And a single stone had come winging down the side of Annapurna and hit Alex on the head. He wasn't wearing a helmet at that point. They thought they were on safe ground. They were unroped. So this single stone came, hit him on the head, and killed him instantly.
Mm. Well, it makes me wonder, though, too, when you talk about the number of people that you knew who had these experiences, how much easier it would be for them to share even with you about what they experienced or what their friends experienced, because you're kind of in sort of an inner circle of these climbers. Who reached out to you that surprised you? Who told you a story where, and you didn't have any personal experience with them, you didn't share any, you hadn't shared any of these expeditions, but they felt the need to tell you something?
The couple that I told you about early in the interview, who both mm-hmm. sent the Tibetan woman, I had never met them before. I phoned them up. There was another woman who, two different women actually, who'd lost their partners, one in a climbing accident, another in a kayaking accident, who told me stories of one of them actually saw her husband's spirit visually appear before her, or his ghost before her.
Where was she?
She was in Salt Lake City. She was sitting on her exercise bike first thing in the morning, and she suddenly saw him appear in front of her, so close and so clear that she said she could see his chest hairs, and he just appeared. And she had and this is sort of a common thing. She had this sense of reassurance and calmness and peacefulness, and then he just disappeared again. At the time, as far as she knew, he was climbing in Alaska on the Ruth Glacier, and what she didn't know at that point was 10 hours earlier, a massive serac had collapsed and an ice block had collapsed and killed him. And it was 6 hours after that that she got the news that he was dead. And she said, you know, she said she had never believed in ghosts or spirits or anything, but this happened to her before she knew he was dead. And so, you know, that really convinced her that he had come to her with some message.
I'm not trying to put too fine a point on it, but it's interesting that she, too, was exercising at that moment then.
I don't think it was extreme. You know, she was just right on her exercise bike with a book in front of her, you know, doing the morning workout. There was another woman whose boyfriend died in a kayaking accident. He was drowned while whitewater kayaking. And she'd actually had already heard that he had died, and she was really distraught. This was the first night after she'd heard. And she was lying in bed on her back, which she doesn't normally sleep like that. And she woke up from this sleep with this sense of something hovering above her. And she felt what she felt was somebody kind of hook underneath her shoulder blade. She said it was as if it was like a helium balloon hovering above her, but sort of hooked underneath her. And she suddenly realized it was Jeff, her boyfriend. And she felt him basically come in very close to her and hold her. And actually, I mean, it wasn't a sexual thing at all, but actually basically sort of come right through her, if you see what I mean, just sort of hold her very closely.
Right, right, right.
And she said she lay there for a long, long time and was talking to him, and basically at one point said, "Jeff, I've got to turn on my side, so hold on," because she was terrified of losing this sense of him. Now, months later,
What happened when she turned on her side?
Oh, he was still there.
Okay, good.
He was just worried he'd float off.
Okay, so they turned on her side, and they continued to have this kind of communion.
Holding each other, yeah.
Oh,
and it went on for a long time. Now, the interesting thing is, months later, she was in the Ecuadorian Andes, on holiday trekking, and she was in a village, and she met a village elder, and she was telling him this story about how her boyfriend had drowned, and she'd had this sense of his spirit coming back and holding on to her. And he said, "Were you lying on your back with your hands on your chest when it happened?" And he asked her to show him her position, and she'd actually been lying with her hands sort of almost crossed on her chest. And he said, "Ah, I thought so, because when you lie like that, that's how the spirits can come in."
Get out.
Yes, that is absolutely true.
Get out.
Yeah.
And they get in there because what? Because they don't like to spoon?
He didn't give any explanation.
Spirits don't like spooning. Have a thing about spooning spirits. Well, okay, this brings us to the top of the hour, and as I promised, I'm going to be totally selfish. And then, we'll give you the numbers at the top of the hour, but I won't promise you'll get through right away. We're talking with the Maria Coffey, Explorers of the Infinite is the book, The Secret Spiritual Lives of Extreme Athletes and What They Reveal About Near-Death Experiences, Psychic Communication, and Touching the Beyond. We haven't touched everything yet in this book, and I want to do a little bit more before we give it entirely over to the direction that you'll go with it. And I don't know whether there are any extreme athletes that are listening that would like to share their experience, whether they have something that they went through. But I guess it wouldn't even have to be extreme athletes. It's just anything that pushes you into that zone. So I could kind of almost see, Maria, where people who are doing deep sea fishing in Alaska or something, or people who are, you know, scuba diving or something, that anytime that they're in a place where they are entering into an area where they may be touching the infinite, where they may be rubbing up against a dimension which they ordinarily don't see. Mm-hmm. Wherever that may be for you, if you want to share your stories coming up, we'll get a couple of those. And your questions for Maria Coffey, just maybe not as many as we usually do in our last hour of Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So we're heading into our last hour. Excuse me, suddenly my throat closed up all of a sudden. And we're talking with Maria Coffey. We've been talking about oxygen and deprivation and that these stories that are reported to her are more than just some physiological reaction to aloneness or to terror or to even just to extreme temperatures, because the athletes that were involved in these adventures were already used to stuff like this. There's something different about the way in which their souls seem to reach a different level during these extreme activities. And we were talking a lot about altitude, right? We're talking a lot about base jumpers or climbers, but what about divers? I'd thrown that in there at the end of the hour, thinking maybe there'd be some people out there that might have some stories of their own they'd like to share. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention that there are already some recollections like that in the book, which we'll get to next, along with your calls. Explorers of the Infinite, Maria Coffey, then. We'll go under sea level and see whether the extreme adventurers that she writes about had the same experiences next. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Like I warned you, I'm going to be a little selfish with Maria Coffey before we get to the phones, but I promise by the end of this half hour, we'll take a couple of calls. But let's talk about some of the divers. We've been above the sea level. We've been at sea level. So let's just make it clear that even if one has an oxygen tank on and one's getting pure O2, they could still be experiencing some of these amazing crossovers, and Maria Coffey writes about that in the book Explorers of the Infinite. Where do you want to pick that up?
Divers that I interviewed didn't have oxygen tanks on. They're the free divers who take a breath and then dive hundreds of feet in the ocean without a tank.
I hadn't realized that all of them were free divers, but
yeah, I mean,
fair point then.
Which is, you know, I mean, it's quite amazing what they do. You know, they use what they call the mammalian dive reflex, basically.
Right.
They, you know, they take an enormous breath and saturate themselves with oxygen, and then they hold their breath for up to 7 minutes when they're diving.
And they're there with the whales and the dolphins.
Yeah.
And the...
I mean, I think it's about as close to nature. I think they and the surfers get, you know, just about as close to the great powers of nature as you possibly can by doing that. And they've, you know, some of them have talked about amazing experiences. There's a Canadian free diver called Mandy Ray Cruikshank, and she talked about leading up to a dive to which she was going to dive 214 feet, I think it was, in Hawaii. She spent 7 minutes. They spend 7 minutes breathing up, kind of getting as much oxygen as they can into their body before they take the final big breath. And she said there were people all around her. It was in a competition, so there were boats all around her. There were cameras. There were people yelling instructions. But suddenly, as she started the dive, everything disappeared. As she dived down, there were people at different levels taking photographs. But she didn't – everything just disappeared. She didn't see the camera flashes. She didn't see the people. She just got completely pulled into herself, so deeply focused that literally all these things disappeared.
I will tell you that my diving adventure was brief. I've only done that a couple of times, but I did have an Into the Infinite experience on one of my first ocean dives. Have you ever done that yourself?
I've done Maria? One ocean dive.
So I went down and I was following the rope, right, which trailed off into the abyss, even though we were only diving 50, 75 feet, whatever it was. But there had been enough silt or sand that had been kicked up that you couldn't see the end of the rope. So as we're all pulling down, going deeper and deeper and deeper, you literally couldn't see what you were going into. I mean, it was, you know, as they say, every act of faith has an element of risk, or it's not an act of faith. Mm-hmm. And it was just so there was just that act of faith of just saying, well, there are other people down there that are waiting for me. And I remember that particular time that it was as close as I could relate to when I was reading your book of having that type of infinite experience where it's nothing to speak of. I mean, it wasn't anything interdimensional or anything, but I suddenly felt it was the first time in my life that I had ever felt like I was in a place where I shouldn't be.
Oh, really?
I didn't feel my human dominion at all. And so suddenly I felt a little bit like that old sci-fi movie, the incredible Shrinking Man, where, you know, he's suddenly an inch and a half tall and he's have to battle house cats and spiders and everything that were otherwise something that he would have dominated. And suddenly now he was fighting for his life. And that is exactly how I felt. And I remember looking up the rope when I got to the bottom and having the same experience going back up it again, because you couldn't see that there was a boat waiting on the other side. It was just it was like Jacob's ladder into heaven. And you just had to take hand over hand, assuming that it was going to lead you somewhere. And I remember getting, once I got out of the ocean, I'd never felt more at one with creation as a whole. And I felt privileged to be there, like I had been allowed into, it was almost like a seance or something. Mm-hmm. I'd been allowed to feel like I had been somewhere that I without a hall pass. Somehow I'd just gotten there on my own.
It sounds like, I mean, I think, you know, I said before one of the components is fear, but by fear I also mean awe.
Right, or respect.
And I think that is. I mean, I felt that on Everest. You know, the you know, you're tiny. You're this tiny speck. You know, and beneath this great mountain. And I think that's such an important component.
Yeah, I think that it was that sense of this is not possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I told my wife later on. I said the whole time I kept thinking, this is not possible. What I am doing is not possible. I had to keep assuring myself that I really was experiencing it, because I was standing on the bottom of the ocean, although not as deep as other divers go, and I was fully oxygenated. I kept thinking to myself, I don't belong here. Mm-hmm. I'm not supposed to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's just because I knew I looked terrible in the wetsuits and everybody else looked great. So I was reminded of the fact that I really didn't belong there. But you're talking about those free dives and those free divers. What else would they experience typically that might sound similar to the people who are reaching high altitudes then?
They haven't, most of them, the ones I talked to didn't talk about anything necessarily paranormal, but it was this, for all of them, it was this deep, deep connection with the ocean.
Right.
That for them, you know, was the really important thing. They, interestingly, they felt they totally belonged there. I mean, some of them dive to, you know, like 500 feet on one breath. And as you say, they're there swimming with, you know, huge sea creatures like whales. And
right.
And they look like they belong. When you see footage of them, they wear these huge monofins. So they look like mermaids or mermen, you know, moving
right.
through the water.
That's true.
Yeah.
And then, and so since the book has come out, you mentioned earlier the one or two people have been in touch with you and have said, well, I have an experience too. Who else has been in touch? What have they told you that they otherwise may not have told anybody until they saw their experiences in print through somebody else?
I've had people telling me about telepathic experiences that they've had. Now, these are both extreme adventurers, and then people who, you know, just in the mainstream like myself. Because I write about telepathy quite a lot in the book, and a lot of people have said, yeah, you know, I've had a lot of telepathic experiences, and then told me stories about that. I've had surfers talk to me because I write about how I feel that, you know, surfers have a long spiritual tradition behind them, even though they might not be right. aware of it, because, you know, surfing was originally a very spiritual sport
right.
in Hawaii. And I've had surfers coming up and saying, yeah, you know, and we, you know, and they've talked about being so connected with the ocean that they're out there and they know exactly where and when the next wave is going to break. There's no way they could know it, but somehow they just have this, they're so connected with the ocean. They really feel that they have almost this precognition of what's going to happen.
Well, as you point out in the book, that's like the snowboarder. That's the soul riding in a
right.
way. It's just
right.
in.
And I've had people who've been on long ski touring expeditions. Again, talking about as a team, they don't even have to talk to each other. They can be at a distance from each other, and they're basically communicating with each other in a telepathic way. You know, so a lot of people are sort of coming out of the woodwork now and saying, yeah, and often quite young, you know, I thought when I first started this work that, you know, maybe the new young hotshot skiers and snowboarders might just laugh at this, but it's quite the opposite. They're extremely open. One skier and snowboarder, Jimmy Chin, turned to me and said, well, of course it's all spiritual. Why else do you think we do it?
Mm. Love that. Let's reserve some time to talk a little bit more about telepathy before the end of the hour. But let's bring in John on a wildcard line in Long Island on Coast to Coast AM for Maria Coffey, Explorers of the Infinite. John?
Hello, Ian. Hello, Maria. Hi. How are you doing tonight?
Hello there.
Okay, my question is, I'm assuming you're married, you remarried. Is your present husband ever experienced any paranormal activity? Might be pertaining to your last husband. Has he ever complained being home alone or sense anything?
No,
well,
my present husband is a dyed-in-the-wool scientist. And he's always saying, you know, if only he could have a spiritual and mystical experience, that he would then believe in it.
Huh.
Having said that, he isn't a completely in-the-box scientist. I mean, he is open to the fact that there are experiences, there are things that science can't explain. But he himself has never had a mystical or paranormal experience.
Not even telepathy.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, I should ask him about that because, you know, on the long trips we've been on together, there's absolutely no doubt that, like many couples who are very close, you know, we'll think the same thought at the same time, or he'll know what I'm thinking or feeling. I mean, that definitely happens, particularly when we're out in the wilds together. You know, we begin working like this well-oiled machine. You know, we don't even
right.
have to explain things to each other.
But also, I was thinking of him more because he's also a veterinarian, is he?
He is, yeah.
Right? People that work closely with animals, in my experience, can't ever just be purely scientific. That there seems
yeah,
to be...
he's highly... It's very true, actually. He's highly intuitive.
Yeah,
and watching him work with animals, that really comes out.
How can you not be? How can you be highly intuitive and not have a sense of the divine or the mystical?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no rational explanation for intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, at least there is, but it never seems to be complete.
You're absolutely right, and I think, you know, that is kind of an abiding problem in our society that people. So many people say, oh, no, I don't believe in any of this stuff. And then they talk about their intuition. And, you know, I have a whole chapter in the book on intuition because what else is intuition but something that a sixth sense that we have or some other sense that isn't really explainable?
Yeah, I think intuition is greater than the sum of its parts.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, we can take in a variety of physical experiences or sensory perception, but there's something intuitive. When something reaches to a level of intuition, it goes beyond what we could have seen, and it truly is something. It's a vibration. It's something that your body, your mind gets attuned to.
Mm-hmm. The translation from Latin is knowing without knowing. I mean, it's something that, as you say, it is. It's another sense.
Yeah, I would think working with animals, that would be something that he would come to depend on. First time caller line, Philip is in Connecticut on Coast to Coast AM for Maria Coffee. Go ahead, Philip.
Yes, just a quick introduction. I have done most of those things. I've scuba dived and I've skydived, and I'm a pilot. And in fact, that's one of the stories I've had. And I have experienced some of the feeling you're talking about, but not to the extent that you're describing. It's a good feeling. It's a peaceful feeling for me, but it's not maybe not quite as spiritual as you're describing. But just to give a quickie on what had happened to me, I was training as a flight instructor for a multi-engine. Actually, it wasn't even an instructor at the time. It was just a multi-engine training. And I was having a conversation with my instructor, and we had seen something in the newspaper or something had set us off. We talked about, you know, crashing and, you know, what would happen and what kind of crash would we be in if something terrible were to happen. And he had made some comment that he said that, well, you know, it'd probably be one of these fiery crashes or something like that. And I said, you know, I don't think so. I think, you know, it probably would just take off. The airplane might stall or something might happen and turn and pancake in and go through an airport fence and into the embankment or something like that. And then he had gone to the extent to say, well, you know, if I was skidding along like that just before the crash, I would take my seatbelt off. I think I would have a better chance in getting ejected out of the airplane. Well, what I just described was exactly what happened about a week later. And I'd even talked to him about getting insurance and everything else. So it was...
What happened? It happened to him?
It happened to him.
Was he killed?
Later. He was killed, and he didn't have a seatbelt on, and he got ejected out of the airplane. There was an embankment there. There was an airport fence. The airplane had turned, and it was, you know, some kind of a setup problem with the airplane prior to takeoff. I don't know if they gotten all the trims back together or something. Both people died, the student and him. And it was kind of a premonition before it all happened, I guess. And I don't know why I described that to him, why I cautioned him to make sure he had insurance, and went through the whole thing. Another time, I was skydiving. And I had introduced... My girlfriend to skydiving area, and I said, oh, that's, I don't mention the guy's name over there, and he was my instructor, and I said, you know, he's the kind of guy that would follow you right down. If you didn't pull your chute in time, he would follow you down. And I guess about a week later, some woman had jumped out, and she didn't pull right away, and he followed her down, and he didn't get his chute out quick enough. So
just trying to weird, help her.
Just weird stuff like that I had thought of beforehand that I had connected to and had this mental image.
Sure.
And
you know, Philip, I want to go back to something that Maria just said though just a few minutes ago. When you said you talk to people who preface their comments by talking about how they've really never had an experience like that, and then they go ahead and they describe an experience like that. That's just what Philip did. He said, He sort of talked down what he went through, and then these are highly qualified experiences for the subject matter of your book. Isn't that weird? Why do we do that? Why do we invalidate an experience which we hold to be so unique and otherworldly?
Because I think they're not acceptable in our society by so many people. You know, it's the whole rational thinking thing since the scientific revolution, you know, in the 17th century. You know, that's still the mode of thinking, you know, that,
sure.
You know, everything has to have an explanation. And if it doesn't, it's not real.
Well, Philip, if you're still listening, you had those experiences. Guess what? You've already had them, and very interesting. Bob is west of the Rockies in Beaverton, Oregon, on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Bob.
Hello there, Ian, and hello, Maria.
Hello.
I've been researching this kind of thing for 40 years, and one of the most important things I found is an item by Professor Colin Blakemore in Nature magazine back in April of 1986. He attributed to two men, Kenneth Craik and David Marr, the idea that the mind builds a three-dimensional model of our environment. And so on the case where the man could see the blue light that was guiding him to go get help for his friend, it was his own subconscious mind that was more than likely providing the blue light, because in earthquake stuff, earthquake-sensitive people, they hear sounds. Soldiers in combat will hear a voice that tells them what to do, because their subconscious mind can see what's going on around them and what their environment is.
Well, that's cool enough right there. I mean, you may be right, but that's still incredibly cool to think that we could be having that going on at the same time. Well, that is just another way of looking at the infinite. It's the unconscious experience we're having, and every so once in a while, the wall breaks down. And our conscious self sees and feels what our unconscious self may be aware of all the time. And we'll keep exploring the infinite coming up next with Maria Coffey in our last half hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, you never know what's going to happen when you are exploring the infinite, when you're pushing your body to an extreme. You're finding those places both inside of you and somewhere on the planet where the space between this world and the next seems like it's at its thinnest, you might be encountering the same types of things that Maria Coffey writes about in Explorers of the Infinite, whether it's because you just pushed your body to the point where your defenses are down, you are maybe more vulnerable to the dimensions of the world that is all around us, or maybe it is some sort of physiological reaction which we just don't understand. But somehow that just doesn't seem likely after you hear about all of these experiences. And Maria mentioned earlier the large work she does on telepathy in the book, and so we'll get to that before the hour is done. A couple of your phone calls, your own experiences, perhaps, where you already have pushed your body and your mind and your soul to the brink, and what happened to you when you did, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Explorers of the Infinite is the book. You can link up to Maria Coffey's website to hiddenplaces.net and consider what might be in your future, some adventure travel to some hidden places around the planet through coasttocoastam.com. You can find everything you need there. And Maria, if you're ready, let's go ahead and make sure we save like 5 minutes at the end of the show to pick up on that thread of telepathy. But do you want to grab a few more calls on this? Wildcard line, Harry is in Texas on Coast to Coast AM for Maria Coffey. Go ahead, Harry.
Hello there. I've been a deer hunter for over 40 years. And about 20 years ago, I was bow hunting down in South Texas in the brush country. And I'd had three bucks that went by, and I started tracking them. And, you know, you're very still and you're very quiet. And I was going through this creek bottom. It's about 8 feet wide and had about a 6-foot bank on it. Well, all of a sudden, I got this really strange feeling. And at the time, I just felt like I was zoning out, like I was not even part of my body. And felt kind of fuzzy and everything. And then all of a sudden, when everything became clear again, just in time to see a mountain lion that is hindquarters walking out of the creek bottom about 20 feet from me. So I've always wondered if, you know, that was some kind of old hunting spirit that was coming into me, or maybe the presence of that mountain lion. If you've ever seen one, it's really it's like a religious experience when you see them in the wild.
I bet.
But
that sounds similar to Native American experiences I've heard.
Mm-hmm. I've hunted for over 4 years, and I have a great respect for wildlife, and I've had a connection to them where you can almost sense when they're coming, but nothing to that extreme.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's very interesting, Harry. I appreciate you doing. I think that that does say then that, again, once you're out, you're sort of disoriented from your normal life. There you are in the middle of the woods. It's you. It's nature. that you don't have to be necessarily on the outer edges of the experience of this earth. You can be safely in the woods and still feel out of it at the same time. Helena in Los Angeles, or is it Helena? What do you?
Helena. That's
Hi,
fine,
Helena.
But Helena's okay. Hi, Ian. It's good to talk with you. I just wondered if Maria has heard of the book Surfing Himalayas, which is about a snowboarding adventure, spiritual adventure, or another book which was a sequel to it, Snowboarding to Nirvana. Both books were written by Dr. Frederick Lenz, an American, well, actually, he was an enlightened sage.
Maria?
I have heard of them. You know, I dipped into them briefly. I read a million books when I was researching this, but I can't say that I read them very carefully. So I'm interested to hear what you think about them.
Well, Dr. Lenz was my spiritual teacher, and I met him in 1980, and he could just light up a room with the light of golden light of enlightenment, and he was into extreme sports. Like he even would do extreme diving, skin diving, and then he wrote these books about snowboarding. The first one, Surfing Himalayas, was written in 1995, and he kept on saying that snowboarding was really going to take off as a sport. And it's about a young man who wants to snowboard the highest mountain. He goes to the Himalayas, and he's snowboards into a Buddhist monk who's his spiritual teacher, and then Snowboarding to Nirvana is the sequel. And then a curious thing about Dr. Lenz is that his first cousin was Art Bell.
Well, I didn't know that.
No, not many people do.
Oh, that is quite curious. I'd have to ask Art about that sometime. Well, thank you, and that's a interesting legacy connection to the show. I wonder whether they ever did a radio program and whether it could have been half as much fun as I'm having right now with Maria Coffey. Let's do Tricia in California too on Coast to Coast AM for Maria Coffey. Tricia,
hi Ian, how are you? Hi, Mrs. Coffey.
Hello.
I'm so glad that I got on during the subject, because I have so many stories about things that have happened to me out in the wilderness.
What do you do that's extreme?
Well, I hike, but I like to really put distance behind me. And I'm something you had said before about deprivation.
Mm-hmm.
The deprivation that I am addicted to is solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I really,
It's very interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like to get way out there just by myself. I think that it's good just to hear your own voice for very, like, quite a few days. You know, don't look at another face, don't hear another voice, don't hear a car or anything. So I'm like probably 3 days out I think I planned like a 2-week trip up in the Sierra Nevadas, and dropped down into a canyon. I'm kind of nervous. I had a sense of being watched. And like a couple callers before, mountain lions, you can kind of feel them, you know? They have a real intense kind of feeling. So I took all those precautions. And then I kept on hiking. I found this spot. I sat and had some lunch, and something about the area, like the trees were in this weird circle with like these two other two trees, like in an X. It looked like I was at a small forum kind of thing. And I thought it was unusual, and I let my curiosity, Little Red Riding Hood, I went off the trail and I started walking through these small little trails. And I was, like, almost giddy, you know, with letting my curiosity take me. And I go out through the forest. I don't have my pack on. I'm finishing my sandwich, and the trail gets smaller, smaller, and narrower, and narrower. And all of a sudden, in my head, there was a voice that said, they're going to get you lost, or they're trying to get you lost. But I thought it was very strange that it said, they're getting you lost, not I said to myself, I'm going to get lost. And I turned on my heels and just took off running. And I made it to camp like hours early. And something that I do.
What was the they?
I don't know. But like through this whole like deep canyon that I had gone through, I just had this feeling that I was being watched. And that voice like said, they're trying to get you lost. And I turned and I took off. And it was just, it was the weirdest thing because like my curiosity like just kept me going through this little path. It wasn't going anywhere. I was getting away from my pack and my supplies. My map, my compass.
I want to hang on to that thought for a second. Don't go anywhere, Tricia. But Maria, we talked before about the spirit of the Ganges that you felt while you were riding down in the kayak, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or before when other people were talking about the spirit of the mountain, and you spoke about it in a benevolent sense.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody ever written to you? And perhaps this is what Tricia is hinting at. And again, Tricia, hang on. A malevolent spirit.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, there is quite a tradition of that. You know, the ancient Greeks, you know, the word panic comes from the god Pan, because when they were out in the wilderness, they were always terrified of running across Pan, who would do them great harm. And I've talked to climbers who, there are certain areas where they go to where, you know, they all get a very, very bad feeling. There's one mountain in Scotland where there's actually something called mountain panic that people experience in certain places. And some people think that maybe it is the spirit of that place. It is not a friendly spirit. So certainly there are those stories there too. And I've experienced that too, of, you know, getting unaccountable feelings of panic or an ease and feeling I've just got to get out of somewhere without really knowing why. And so many climbers have told me about, and not just climbers, but skiers and surfers and all sorts of people, you know, adventurers have said they've been in situations and they've said, this is not good. We don't know why, but we're just getting out of here right now. And they, you know, the more extreme and the more experienced the adventurer is, the more they will listen to that intuition always.
Well, maybe that's what you were experiencing, Tricia, was the conflict between the still small voice inside you that said, don't listen to them. Those, I don't know, I'll just say it. I don't know whether it's true or not. I don't know these things, but that somehow there was some malevolent spirit or spirits that were luring you to your death.
Yeah, and then on the flip side, later that day, like I said, I took off and I got to camp early, and I chose a camp that was way off the trail because I like solitude. I chose a camp that it had been abandoned by the Forest Service, and so it was really in ruins, and so I decided to dismantle what was left of the other two little spots and really clean up the one, and I had to work, like, you know, an hour on it, cleaning up the site. And I had a pair of leather gloves and that you just kind of always, you know, work with. They replaced lots of things, pot holders and stuff.
Right.
And the next morning, I had them, okay, that night I fell asleep, I put them on a stump that was by my tent. I got up the next morning, I put on the gloves, and a dime fell out. Now, how could I work all day with a dime in a tight leather glove? It couldn't have happened. And I was 3 days out from anyone. I felt that was like a, okay, you can pass and here's your reward. Whatever kind of weird thing was there, I don't know, wood elves, nymphs, fairies, I don't know. I can't see what it is.
Tricia, I'm so glad you shared that story with us. I think you're going to really enjoy Explorers of the Infinite. I hope you pick up a copy of the book from Maria Coffey. Virtue gets the last call on this, and then we'll put it to bed for the night. Virtue?
Hi, guys. Wow, thank you. I feel special. Hi, Maria. Hi,
Hello.
How are you?
Hi.
I have a neat story. I did Cats on Broadway.
And I got the job because a girl got pregnant and she had to leave the show. And I had to learn the show in 3 days. And what they did was, instead of ever rehearsing with the cast, the opening night for me, they just dropped me in the show. So I never, ever rehearsed a full-on two-hour show with 30 people on stage. Not one time did I ever hit, touch, or brush another human being. And I think that is completely miraculous. How does that work? I mean, even with the traffic, just the people, and how difficult the dancing is in that show.
Sure.
That, I mean, to me, that is completely, and it is an extreme sport to dance like that.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is intense, you know. So I've never, ever understood it today, till this day, how I could get through that without ever rehearsing a show with those people.
Yeah, I have a larger question, and it's how did you ever get through being in Cats, period? But that's, for me, I just don't love that show. Like, but I'm sure you were great in it. I'm sure you were fabulous in it. But that's a kind of another interesting way of looking at it, just being able to move around other people, and despite how many people are there, never touching them. Well, that brings us to maybe a kind of telepathy, a kind of an awareness of one's physical space as it relates to somebody else. And you explore that in Explorers of the Infinite. You talked about you being telepathic. Where did that cross over into the lives of extreme athletes?
Telepathy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There are so many stories of telepathy that I've been told by all sorts of athletes. For example, one man who was sailing in the Southern Ocean in a race, his boat was knocked down by a huge wave. He was trapped for 5 days underneath the hull of his boat. And he and his wife, who was in Britain, began communicating telepathically. And they both talk about it separately, about, you know, how they were actually having conversations, how she was reassuring him, how she was telling him that help was on the way. There are twins that I write about in the book, climbing twins, who talk about telepathic experiences they've had at distance. Carlos Cosolio, who I talked about at the beginning of the program, was climbing in the Himalayas with a mixed international team, Polish and Spanish and English, and the Poles, the only common language was English. But they always used to speak in English, but they were up in this very, very extreme situation on the mountain. They had walkie-talkie radios. They were communicating with each other by radio because the blizzard was so bad they couldn't even see each other. And they were being recorded. Their conversation was being recorded at base camp. When they got back down to base camp, and they were understanding each other on the mountain, they had to understand each other to get down properly. When they got down to base camp, they found out that they were speaking in their own languages. So the Poles were speaking Polish. Carlos was speaking Spanish. He didn't understand Polish. The Poles didn't understand Spanish. But on the mountain, they had understood each other perfectly. They got back. They listened to the tape. They couldn't believe it. They couldn't understand each other when they were listening to the recording. So, I mean, there was some sort of communication that was telepathic or whatever that went beyond normal communication happening on the mountain.
Well, you know, I have to throw in a thought on that. Again, it comes back to something that's this time in the Christian Bible. That's the story of Pentecost, that everybody was speaking different languages and everybody could understand each other
yes.
at the same moment. That deeply spiritual sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so intriguing to me that this is the recurring experience of extreme athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you do it beautifully. You know, there's a way you're doing something. You're doing very interesting work here. I'm going to tell you, you're doing very interesting theological work. Here's why.
Thank you.
That's true. There's an idea for chaplaincy, right? That every chaplain is part poet, part prophet, and part priest.
Mm-hmm.
That the prophet part is that you speak for people who don't have a voice or are reluctant to share their voice. That's the mm-hmm. prophetic part. The poetic part is that you're finding vocabulary for them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're putting their experiences in a form that they can help, that helps them process it. Now, the only piece that's missing, and I'd be really curious about this someday, and the priestly part is whether it's ever been ritualized.
Mm.
so that people would have a way of being able to share that experience communally more easily with each other.
Maybe that's the next stage for them.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be interesting to see if people start to ritualize those mystical experiences, whether it's on the top of a mountain or the bottom of an ocean?
Right. Maybe the book will help them do that.
I think you've helped in a big way, and I know you've helped me. Just a tremendous spirit you shared with us all, and thank you. I know that people are going to love this, and I would love someday to be able to join you on one of your international travel adventures too.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Maria Coffey, Explorers of the Infinite. Thank you too. Have a great week, everybody. See you next Saturday. Deus te amat, and I do too.